sound will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. Greetings! Yes, it is 19 hours UTC, Saturday, August the 12th in the glorious future year of 2023, and I'm back in Texas, after a month in Canada. Manitoba, Grand Beach Provincial Park, north of Winnipeg, which is a very pleasant place to spend your late July, early August. I will mention, for those who don't know, that the 7th of August is my birthday. I think I've mentioned that before, so it's not really giving you the wherewithal to dox me if you haven't done it already. But this year, that was a provincial holiday in several of the Canadian provinces. I don't know that it commemorates much of anything. As far as I'm aware, it's simply a way to give everybody a long weekend while the weather is fine. And I am in favor of this. Of course, down in New South Wales, is it? Or I believe it's New South Wales, or is it Queensland? Rolly, our token Australian on and on radio these days, since Bronzy Beat hasn't been on in a while, is experiencing winter weather. Which is probably not very different if he's in Queensland. Probably not very different from the summer weather up on Lake Winnipeg. Let's see. I will mention, if you haven't had a look at my Patreon lately, which is patreon.com/man_and_Adam. I made some badges for the NASFIC because it started on July 20th, of course, the glorious 20th of July. And those of my Patreon supporters at the $5 and up level will receive those badges. I did distribute some at the convention. Some people gave me money for them, some people didn't. But I have already sent them to one person in Canada who accidentally got two parcels and had to pay for one of them because the friend I was staying with mistakenly picked it up and shoved it in the mail slot without observing it didn't have postage on it. Anyhow, that's life. But for those of you who are supporting me at the $5 a month and above level and are not in Canada, you will receive them sooner or later. The U.S. ones will probably go out in the next week or so, and non-U.S. ones will have to wait. I may handle those the next time I'm in Germany, or I may give them to someone visiting from Germany to handle them, but either way. The parcels that I was awaiting, the stuff I've had shipped back from the convention, arrived today, more or less intact, which is what I've come to expect from UPS for $180. They charge you a whole bunch of money, and your pieces might not be completely destroyed when they arrive to you. And that's about all you can ask for. Yay. Let's see. So I have the So I spent quite a bit of time Tuesday and Wednesday with the little netbook. I discovered, to my horror, that yes, what had been stopping it from booting was simply that it didn't have the battery installed. If you hadn't heard previous show, so what happened was that I had brought the two German payphones and the ATA which runs them, and the netbook which runs Asterisk to tell the ATA what to do, to the NASFIC with the idea of having a deal where people could sit down and they could put a coin in the slot and listen to a recorded message about nuclear energy. And I've got hours and hours of these messages off of LPs that were produced for radio broadcast in the 60s and 70s by Argonne National Laboratory and by the American Nuclear Society. And there are a few more of such LPs out there which I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on. But that's another story. Anyway, when I got there, the setup would not work because the netbook wouldn't boot. What had happened was that I was packing with the intent of traveling by Amtrak, but I could not get Amtrak to sell me a ticket. And therefore I had to change my plans and go by air, which wound up buying a first-class air ticket because that meant I had a heavier baggage allowance. And on Amtrak you can take more baggage than you can on an airliner, so I had to shove everything I could possibly shove into two suitcases, making them very heavy and prone to being damaged. And indeed, one of the two suitcases is basically destroyed at this point. Two of the casters are broken, and there's a puncture through the side of the suitcase, which I don't know how that happened. Anyhow, but that's by the way. What happened was, of course, since you can't put lithium-ion batteries, like laptop batteries, into airline baggage, I took the battery out of the little netbook, and I took the battery out of the video player, little portable DVD player, which I use for playing the nuclear energy videos and space travel videos and so forth that I've had transferred from film. Anyway, those batteries I put to one side, and I did not put them into my carry-on baggage. And when I got to the convention and started setting things up, the video player worked fine, but the netbook would not boot. And then I tried several things to make it work, all of which only made things worse. And because I was also trying to make it work with my regular laptop, and I said, well, if I can make the Asterisk software work with my regular laptop, then I'll at least have a solution to this, even if it's not a very good one. Well, that didn't work either, but in the process I wound up completely reformatting the small SSD which goes in the netbook. And so I came back, and after I got home I put the battery in it and discover that, yes, what had been stopping it from booting was that it didn't have the battery. Stupid piece of design there. And then I sat down and reformatted the hard drive again and installed Slackware and compiled the Asterisk software from source and put all the files together and so forth, and it does seem like it's working now. So now all I have to do is unpack the payphones, make sure they're still okay, and so the whole kit will, in fact, be available for future use. I just feel like a complete idiot. Anyhow. But what else is there to think about here? So, as usual, when I pick up the Wall Street Journal, I become senselessly enraged, you know, and so one of the senselessly enraging items in today's Wall Street Journal is a big feature about, you know, robo-nannies for your children, AI nanny. And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, so this is for the person who is definitely the target reader of the Wall Street Journal. If they're going to have a kid, they want to absolutely control every moment of that kid's life with constant surveillance and supervision, because they don't want the kid to turn out any different from what they expect the kid to turn out. And, of course, they don't want to care for the child themselves. No. But they're also not going to pay someone money to care for the child. No. So what do they want to do? They want to entrust the child to an AI. Now, it seems to me that this is a good recipe for creating sociopaths? And certainly for creating people with, you know, for raising a child with a personality that's going to be, going to have some serious rough edges on it. But, I mean, the thing is, readers of the Wall Street Journal are probably more likely than the general public to be psychopaths or sociopaths. And they're from a class of people who are trained, even if they're not sociopaths, to exhibit sociopath-type behavior. So I guess they figure that's okay. But it brings me to this really interesting point, which is that a friend of mine at the NASFIC was sitting down and talking to somebody who turned out to be an admissions officer with MIT and also a professional engineer. And this admissions officer was saying that there are two things she looks for. You know, she's not interested in your academic marks very much. She's not interested in your resume of all the volunteer stuff you've done and the campouts you've attended and this, that, and the other thing. All the things that parents are constantly trying to min-max and optimize so that their kid has the perfect character sheet to get into the university they think the kid should get into. Not the one of the kid's choice, of course, but the one of their choice. Because after all, kids are dumb. Why? How could they possibly make a right decision? Well, you know, I mean, this is, of course, a well-known problem that we're basing the future of our world on decisions that people make before age 18 as to what university major they want to go in or whether they want to go to university or a trade school or blah, 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 right? This is a well-known problem, but there's two things the MIT admissions officer looks for. The first question is, do you read for pleasure? If you don't read for pleasure, you shouldn't be applying to any university, period. I'll say that as often as anyone wants to hear it. If you don't read for pleasure, you have no place applying to a university. You'll just be taking up space that could be occupied by someone who will get something out of the experience. But the second question that she wants to know the answer to is, what was one thing you've done that your parents didn't instigate? Not necessarily something they disapproved of, simply something that they didn't set you on to doing. Something they didn't instigate, they didn't suggest, they didn't plan out for you. Something that was your idea, your initiative. And remember, this is somebody who's, you know, interviewing candidates for MIT, some of them as young as 13 or 14. And if you've never been allowed to have an original thought in your life because your parents have scheduled every minute of your time since you were born, then you're not going to have the necessary mindset for example, an engineer. That's anybody who knows engineers, who understands engineering, will get that immediately. That it is very much a creative profession, and it is also very, very much a profession in which you have to take the initiative. And so, just following instructions isn't going to do anything for you. So yeah, basically, in another generation or so, if this is the standard, MIT won't be admitting any students from the U.S. at all. Whereas in Germany and Japan, which are generally thought of as very rigid, hidebound cultures, children are given a lot of freedom and responsibility. You know, that there's even a Japanese TV show which just follows 4- and 5-year-olds who are being sent out to the grocery store and things like that. It's considered normal to, you know, give your 5-year-old a 500 yen coin and send him down to the grocery store to get a jug of milk or something. Anyway, but I found that very interesting, that the people who are reading the Wall Street Journal, at least, are dead set, in a sense, on micromanaging their children as much as they micromanage their employees. And that's probably going to in the end, hollow out their own existence, in a sense, that we've already seen. People are talking about, you know, return to office mandates and productivity falling. And, you know, the question is, well, why? And the short answer is, well, what's good for business always takes a back seat to what's good for the psychology of the manager class. Yep, self-directed learning. Zoerhoff in Com says, we refer to engineers without initiative as button pushers, and it's not a compliment. Yeah, that's about right. You know, I mean, for all the times in a, you know, in an engineering course where a professor has said something along the lines of, then you put the numbers into the formula, you know, plug and chug. That's what you do after you figure out what formula to use and what the relevant numbers are. That's kind of the key. Anyway, I was listening to the radio news earlier in the week, and they were talking about an economist's study about converting office buildings into residences, because there's less of a demand for offices and more of a demand for residences. Anyway, and they were saying, well, according to our study, 10 to 15% of office buildings might be marginally economical to convert into residences, but it's marginal, so you want to give the real estate developers big tax credits for doing it. And I'm thinking, on the one hand, it probably wouldn't hurt to do that, because if people are moving into these otherwise sort of vacant office towers, then they're going to be spending time, they're going to be spending money in the area and so on, so you probably won't take that big of a hit. But let's go back and figure out what's going on here. Because it wasn't as though they said, well, the landlords are going to be collecting less and less in rent, and therefore they're going to want to sell these buildings, and the city can buy them up cheap as distress sales and then renovate them. You know, there didn't seem to be any discussion of that possibility, right? Because the economics there could be very interesting. On the one hand, as is well known, municipalities and so on can usually borrow money at much cheaper rates than real estate developers can. You know, real estate developers and landlords, you know, there's people taking income out of that. And so obviously, overall, it's going to be more expensive than a not-for-profit situation. Anyway, on the other hand, local governments in the U.S. often pay 5 or 10 times the price for materials and construction that a private entity would. Seriously, I kid you not, I was reading a discussion in the newspaper, I've mentioned this before, of new sidewalks that the city was planning, and as I read it, it became clear to me that the city was paying as much per square meter of sidewalk as you or I would pay to build a house. Given that sidewalks don't have much in the way of utilities, plumbing, fixtures, construction, furnishings, that seemed rather excessive to me. You know, you're talking $1,000 a square meter for sidewalks. Something is very wrong. But it wasn't mentioned at all. There was no mention of my favorite plan, of course. You know, I always, you know, in this case, it would work out to, you have the city or local government body, or even a federal body if necessary, although I'm less favorable toward that just because of the inertia involved, right? And the fact that if it's federal, it's all going to be done one way, whereas you could have many cities trying different things and seeing what worked and hopefully establish best practices, which could then be adopted perhaps nationwide. But even so, there may not be nationwide best practices because of differing regional situations, right? Right. It's kind of one of the things federalism is supposed to be all about. Anyhow, but have the city do it, and then, of course, nobody wants to live in a public housing project. Well, you can tell that to the people in Vienna, where the public housing is very vibrant, and people are happy to be in it. But the thing is, there's nothing stopping the municipality, or maybe in some places there are laws stopping the municipality, or simply inertia and the fact that city councils tend to be under the thumb of real estate developers, from buying these buildings or even seizing them if the landlords have stopped paying taxes on them because they're not getting any rental income, and then renovating them, and then creating a co-op or condominium corporation and bring in occupants who will basically buy the thing from the city for what the city spent on it. And yeah, these are not perfect mechanisms, of course. Far from it. Right. Condominiums require a high level of reinvestment. Right. You can't just set the condo fees arbitrarily low, do no maintenance, and then what happens? Well, you like that place in Florida, your condo collapses, and there's a bunch of people killed, and your house stops existing. That's kind of bad. And condominiums and cooperatives have their problems. But, on the other hand, municipal housing agencies have their problems, landlords have their problems. Letting landlords have all their own way is surely not the best solution to the problem. But the thing is, as I said, it was a study conducted by economists. And the thing I have to say about economists, primarily, is that they serve the same function in relation to the modern ruling classes that soothsayers served in relation to the ruling classes of the ancient world. They provide a seeming divine sanction. And they do this because they use tools resembling those of the exact quantitative sciences. They've got really elaborate mathematical apparatus, right? They've got really vast quantities of data in the form of statistics. What they don't have is a distrust, and I've said this before, a distrust of their underlying assumptions, right? An economist, an engineer, when he does calculations on a building, if he's halfway good engineer, will always distrust his calculations, at least a little bit, because he doesn't know whether the assumptions which go into them are really correct. The assumptions about things like maximum wind speed, maximum snow loading, what have you. A good engineer always distrusts the assumptions that go behind the mathematical relations. He may be sure of his data, he may be sure of the output of his calculations, but he distrusts the input, the assumptions behind those mathematical relations which he's using to perform the calculations. The economist does not. The economist assumes, as an article of faith, that everything necessary for the good and happiness of mankind has already been incorporated into his equations. And so when somebody is outraged, right, this is something I saw the other day, somebody was outraged because people in New York City were being asked to conserve energy by not using their air conditioners if they could possibly avoid it. Which, in some people who are susceptible to heat-related illnesses, weaknesses, injuries, could be deadly. Whereas the big advertising billboards and so forth in Times Square and across the city, those were allowed to continue. And the economist said, I don't see what the problem is. You just allow the price to rise until a new equilibrium is reached. Now, this is exactly the same as saying, I don't see what the problem is. You just allow enough people to starve to death, and then the demand for food will fall, and the famine will be over. You know, that the economist assumes that when equilibrium in his terms of his mathematical relations has been reached, that the optimum in terms of human welfare has been achieved. Is it true? Honestly, it's very unlikely that that's true, but that's economics for you. Of course, the same person, and I was thinking, what in the world? The same person was saying unions are bad because they keep, basically they preserve obsolete jobs. But his example didn't make any sense, which means that I think he needs to go out and get better data. His example was the fact that ports in the United States, seaports, have not mechanized to anything like the degree of the seaports in the Netherlands. Now, this really astonished me, because I was not aware that unions were substantially stronger in the United States than in the Netherlands. I really think that if you're going to look for a reason why the ports in the United States have not been automated, I don't think you need to be looking at the powerful labor unions. I think you need to be looking at the chronic underinvestment in America, particularly underinvestment in infrastructure, particularly underinvestment in publicly owned infrastructure, because, of course, many ports are publicly owned. Right, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, Port of Los Angeles, Port of Long Beach, and so on. I really don't know that blaming the strong, powerful U.S. unions for blocking modernization, whereas the weak and supine Dutch labor unions have allowed modernization to come in and take away all their jobs, I really think that that may be a misdiagnosis of the problem. You know, I'm just saying, but I really do distrust economists a whole lot, and that's an example of why. You know, and the thing is, economists can and do find out, discover, determine useful things, but to a great extent, I fear, they are, as I say, very much like soothsayers. They spend a lot of time telling the people in power what the people want to hear, not examining their assumptions and looking at whether the so-called laws of economics, which are really inferences about human behavior, not laws in the sense that physical laws are laws, right? They're expressed in the same way with mathematical relations, but they're just inferences of human behavior. And human behavior, as we know, is multifarious. And then, I guess Gemlog on SDF Mastodon had reposted a BBC News story about people fleeing from Nigeria, stowing away aboard freighters by climbing up on the rudder and staying there for a week or 10 days in really horrifying conditions. And there was one person quoted as, "In Nigeria there are no jobs, there is no money." And I thought, you know, that's very interesting as a comment, because so many countries nowadays, even Brazil, where these Nigerians happen to end up, are counting on oil development, petrochemical development, to provide the, to provide the revenue they need to jumpstart modern economy. Except that Nigeria is one of the world's largest oil producers. If people are saying in Nigeria there's no money, there are no jobs, well, it's entirely possible that that whole drilling for oil will bring in the money that we need to establish modern, industries and do. It's possible that's just flat wrong. Which is a real good argument for leaving the oil in the ground. Of course, again, I will emphasize that whatever you do with the oil, our society, our civilization needs energy. You know, and that's what I want, is a society which has plenty of energy and doesn't depend for that energy on burning gunk that you dig out of the ground. And people say wind and solar are the way forward, but as I've pointed out, real-world experience, such as that of Germany, doesn't give us any assurance that they'll work to do that, whereas the real-world experience of places like France does give us assurance that nuclear will do that. Which is why I say it's a practical and a moral imperative to use nuclear energy to the maximum. Anyway, but if you want to hear me say that repeatedly, you can tune in every Saturday at 1900 UTC for A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio, the streaming audio service of the SDF Public Access Community. Coming up next is the dubious goal...